Well, let's see if my voice works this morning. Not so well. Maybe I'll try using the audio. Tell me if it works okay here. Yeah. Can you hear me when I talk like that? Okay, I'll not make my voice so loud this time. Okay, so we're predicting rate constants and reactivity relation. And we'll look at the rates of radical chain reactions today. So last time we were talking about what it is that determines bond dissociation energies, whether we can understand it. And we saw that there are these explanations based on hybridization that makes the radical unusually stable when it has sp squared to carbon bonds, and also the possibility of hyperconjugation, that the SOMO can interact with a neighboring CH, HOMO, sigma and sigma star. Both of these suggest that the reason might be that the radicals are unusually stable when they have methyl groups or other alkyl groups in place of hydrogen. But if that's true, that the difference is due to the radical stability, the difference in bond dissociation energies, then it shouldn't make any difference what you're breaking away from it, because you're always getting the same radical. So we should get the same trend we said at the end of last time for the blue curve, that is H breaking away from methyl, ethyl, isopropyl, and T-butyl. And it should be the same when we break T-butyl away, and it is pretty close to the same when we break T-butyl away from methyl, ethyl, isopropyl, and T-butyl. That is the relative energies. But it's not the same for these other alkyl radicals. And in particular, for methyl, there's very little change as you break away. And then we said what might be the reason that T-butyl-T-butyl is easier to break than methyl-T-butyl. And it was pointed out that there should be strain in the starting material that would make it easier to break the bond. So we can use molecular mechanics to calculate how much strain energy there is in the starting material and see if it might be the starting material rather than the radicals that's determining how easy it is to break the bond. So you can do these calculations and you find that there's this much strain energy in the starting material when T-butyl is there. Now, compare those differences with the differences you see in the scale on the left for the difference in the bond dissociation energy. You see there's 12.2 kilocalories of strain in the T-butyl-T-butyl. Now, if you had idealized bond lengths and angles, it would look like that for T-butyl-T-butyl. This is just about how you understand the strain energy. And if you flesh them out with van der Waals radii, you can see that they overlap in the middle. You got a crunch. Okay, and the van der Waals energy calculated with normal bond distances and angles is 26.9 kilocalories per mole. But if you allow the molecular mechanics calculation to relax the molecule to minimize the energy, then it moves back like that and you have less of a crunch, now only 5.2 kilocalories of van der Waals energy, but there's a little strain due to changing the bond lengths and angles. So although the van der Waals energy drops from 16.8 to 5.2, there's the bond stretching and bending increases. So you see, instead of having 109.5 degrees and 1.52 angstroms for that central bond, they go to 112 and 1.57. So that costs you something. It costs you 4.8 kilocalories per mole. So the resultant total strain is 12.2 kilocalories per mole. So 12.2 kilocalories per mole is how much strain there is in T-butyl-T-butyl. And as you make one of the groups smaller, you get less and less. But again, as I say, when we compare this with how much difference there is in the bond dissociation energies, you see that the 9.9 kilocalories difference in the strain in the initial compound, which gets relieved when you break the bond and the groups can move apart from one another, is about the same as the whole 9 kilocalories per mole difference in bond dissociation energy. So if all the radicals had the same energy, this is what you would expect. That difference could come just from the strain in the starting material. Now, is that generally true? Let's look at the methyl. There we have the amount of strain is much less than when you have T-butyl against these other groups, methyl, ethyl, isopropyl, and T-butyl. But again, the range is about the same. as the difference in bond dissociation energy. So you can make a perfectly good argument that the difference in the bond dissociation energies is not due to difference in stability of the radicals themselves, but to due to differences in energy of the starting material. Because all you know from the bond dissociation energy, of course, is the difference between the two, not whether it's because this one's unusual or because this one is unusual. So it's again this this pervasive problem of compared to what. So for X equals alkyl, almost all the methyl to T-butyl change is due to strain energy in the starting material. But not in the case of HR, right? There isn't the strain in the starting material, and still you get this same thing. So textbooks have tended to focus on breaking H away from the alkyl groups, and therefore focused on this difference in the radicals. Now, if we take that same table or the same plot and correct it for how much strain there is in the starting material, I mean, just suppose that there wasn't any van der Waals strain in the starting material. So subtract that out. Then you see that there's hardly any, there's no systematic difference among any of these alkyl-alkyl bond dissociation energies. That's what we said before, that it can all be attributed to strain in the starting material. So this is an alternative to the hypothesis of radical stabilization by getting more substituted radicals. So the intrinsic carbon-carbon bond strength corrected for strain is practically insensitive to substitution. Still, that's not true for the CH bonds. The CH bonds are weakened by alkylation of the carbon. And interestingly enough, carbon-halogen bonds, at least chlorine and bromine, where good data is available, get strengthened by alkylation of the carbon. Just the opposite of what you expected based on hydrogen. So there's no one I know who really understands this, but the textbooks are clearly wrong, or at least greatly oversimplifying things when they attribute it just to stability of the free radicals. However, I'm certain that as we go along, I'll mention stability of the free radicals as if that were an established fact, because everybody assumes it to be, and lots of explanations have been framed in terms of that assumption. But it really isn't true, and I don't know anybody who really understands this. So maybe, unfortunately, it is necessary to memorize that table of all the bond dissociation energies if you don't think you're going to have it available to look up, but probably it will be available if you need it. But at least we can. It's interesting to try to understand these things, but organic chemistry is complicated. So, if we at least know the bond dissociation energies, which we do thanks to people who did the hard work in these tables, can we at least use the bond dissociation energy to predict the activation energy for processes whose rate we would like to know? How can we relate the overall change in energy in a reaction to the energy that's required to get to the activated complex or the transition state, to what determines the rate? How can we relate equilibrium, which we know something about, to rate, which we're trying to predict? So can we use the energies of stable structures that we understand? That's the starting material and the product, and the question of whether we understand them, as we just said, is maybe debatable, to infer the energies of other structures, for example, transition states, and so we can predict reactivity. At least, might it be that exothermic reactions are faster than endothermic ones? And it's easy to, I mean, this is pretty intuitive. If this is a reaction coordinate, right, here's the starting material and the products and activated the transition state up at the top, then you would expect, if things were sensible and looked like packing straps, that as you make the reaction more exothermic, the transition state goes down too. Right? I mean, I'm sure that's what you would guess, that the easier, the more exothermic a reaction, the easier it would be, and the more endothermic, the harder it would be. But might there be even more things about this strap that would help you predict rates of reactions, knowing the exo or endothermicity? So that's what we're going to be talking about for most of the lecture today. So how can we predict activation energy? This is no easy task a priori, especially One reaction with solvent is important, and I alluded to this last time, that most reactions that are involved in organic chemistry involve ions, or at least very many of them do. And when you have ions, they interact strongly with the solvent. So it's oversimplifying to just think of two abstract molecules reacting one another. You have to think where all the solvent is around, and do you have to get solvent out of the way and break attractions with solvent in order to get two molecules together in order to react. So that becomes a very, very much more complicated proposition to try to understand how all these other molecules in the environment are moving. But this is an advantage, as I said last time, in the case of free radicals that interact, that aren't charged, and interact weakly with solvents. So then you can try neglecting the solvent and at least, as a starting point, try to think just of the two molecules that are interacting with one another to form a new bond. Okay, so often, and even in the case when there's solvent, although you can't, it would be very difficult to predict the absolute rate of a reaction. Say this reacts with this, what should the rate constant be? But you might say that if I knew two reagents that were very similar to the ones I'm talking about, undergoing the same simple reaction, that then I might say, be at least able to say, if I made a little change in it, how would that affect the reaction. So most of the time in organic chemistry, when it comes to rates, you're not predicting absolute rates, but predicting relative rates. How is it going to change if you put an extra methyl group on or something? So you need to know something from experiment, some rate, but then you can bootstrap from that to try to predict some other rate. Okay, so it's compared to what again? So you compare something. Now, people often refer to the Hammond postulate, which was stated in these words in 1955 by George Hammond, who incidentally was a graduate student with Professor Bartlett, whom I was also a graduate student with, although he came considerably before me. He said, if two states, as for example a transition state and an unstable intermediate, occur consecutively during a reaction process and have nearly the same energy content, then their interconversion will involve only a small reorganization of the molecular structures. Now, this seems a little abstruse and so on, but it got organic chemists thinking about whether they could understand these elusive species like reaction intermediates that occur only in very, very small concentration and can't often be directly observed, or at least couldn't in those days, and transition states that have no lifetime, so in principle it's impossible to observe them. But might we be able to think about things that if there's a reaction coordinate and two things very close to one another, might we, knowing something about one of them, be able to infer something about the other one? So this got organic chemists thinking about transition states and trying to generalize plausibly about what goes on along reaction coordinates. So the specific words he used aren't so important as the fact that it got people thinking about this. Okay, so here's a picture of this strap I just showed you. And the general idea that if you have a more exothermic reaction, might it be true that the transition state is more similar to starting material, both in energy and structure? Pardon me. Okay, so there's the starting material and the product, and it's very exothermic. And the transition state, you see, is now close to the starting material, both in energy and structure. So this was this idea of the Hammond postulate, that it's going to be rather like, if the reaction is very exothermic, the maximum energy you encounter along the reaction coordinate, which is what's going to determine the rate, has factors that are very similar to the starting material, both energy and structure. Okay, very exothermic, very small activation energy, very early transition state. On the other hand, if the reaction is nearly thermoneutral, then the transition state is going to come sort of halfway along, so it's going to have properties both like the starting material and like the product, at least some properties. And if it's a very endothermic reaction, the transition state should look very much like the product. right? And if you make a change in the, like putting a methyl group on, that change should affect the transition state very much the same the way it changes the energy of the product. So if you know how it changes the energy of the product, for example, how it changes the bond dissociation energy, the difference in energy between starting material and product, it'll change the transition state pretty much the same way. And this will not generally be true. You don't know anything really, truly about the reaction coordinate, these things that you don't have, that you can't observe directly. But at least if you have simple reactions, one-step reactions that are closely analogous to one another, for example, different radicals taking H away from R, so this is a very simple process, then you might expect that changes in R would be understandable in these terms, and that's what we'll try to do here. So likely, there's a continuum between starting material and product with respect to the factors that influence stability. So for example, suppose you have resonance stabilization that's possible in the product of this one-step reaction, that is the free radical that's being formed, where you have a SOMO adjacent to a benzene ring, so you get special stability. But in the starting material, you don't have that possibility because you don't have the SOMO. So there's much more stabilization due to this resonance factor in the product than in the starting material. So might it well then be true that that when you're halfway along, say, in the transition state, that you have something like half that stabilization. So an effect that mostly influences the energy of the product of an endothermic reaction should have a similar but slightly smaller influence on its late transition state. So if the transition state is here very late, you'd expect this much stabilization due to resonance because that much of it has appeared. Resonance has appeared, so it's almost the same as it is in the product, but like that. But if it were a very exothermic reaction, so the transition state occurred very early, then you don't have very much of this resonance stabilization yet, right? So the reaction rate should be more sensitive to resonance stabilization of the radical if the reaction is very endothermic, going uphill. If it's going downhill, it shouldn't be very much affected by that. So this is a logical inference, and we need to check whether it's true. So this says the rates of slower reactions, right, the ones that are going uphill in energy, the rates of slower reactions should be more sensitive to this difference between starting material and product than the rates of rapid reactions, which are happening early and there hasn't been much change yet. And this has been codified as what's been called the reactivity selectivity principle. So here on the left is a reaction that's very exothermic, and on the right is an analogous reaction that's not very exothermic, that's thermoneutral. Pardon me. So the one on the left is more reactive, the one on the right is less reactive, a bigger barrier. Now, if you made some change in the process, putting a methyl group on or changing from one halogen to another, being the radical that's pulling the hydrogen away, pardon me. So if it's more reactive, it'll be more exothermic. And if it's less reactive, it'll be it'll still be more exothermic. That is, the difference between these two is the same as the difference between these two. But this one, being a slower reaction, has more difference at the transition state, as shown here. So the one on the right, the slower reaction, is more selective, and the one on the left has hardly any difference because the difference hasn't begun to manifest itself very early in the reaction coordinate. Is this clear enough so far? Any questions about this? Yeah.
Selective.
Pardon me?
What's selective?
What's what?
What's selective?
Oh, selective means if you have both possibilities happen. So suppose you have two different reagents, three reagents, one reagent that can react with two different reagents. So one of those other reagents is the blue and one is the red. And the question is, which one are you going to react with, the blue or the red? Right? That'll depend on the relative rate with which you would react with blue or react with red, right? So in the first case, by the time you've determined whether you're going to react, there's hardly any difference between blue and red, and you're not going to select between them, right? But here, there's a big difference between blue and red. You'd rather react with red than with blue, right? So in this case of the slower reaction, you as a reagent would be much more selective as to whether you reacted with the blue or the red. But in the first case, the fast reaction, you'd just go 50-50. Sagar? Yeah. Well, that's this Hammond postulate. I didn't dwell on that, and you can spend some more time in the privacy of your room looking at all his words. But he says if two things come very close together along the reaction coordinate, they'll be similar to one another, both in energy and in structure. So both. Okay? Now that's not, you know, this didn't come down on the tablets from Sinai, and it may be that they're reactions that are very exothermic but have very late transition states, right? It might not look the way this you'd guess from this. It might look like that, right? Have a very late transition state even though it's very exothermic. But if things were simple, they would behave the way the Hammond postulate supposes. And more things are simple than are not simple, in this, at least in this respect. Yeah, Derek?
When you're talking about faster and slower, does that mean that the x-axis on all of these diagrams is down?
The x-axis is the reaction coordinate. And we spoke about that lecture before last, I think. And it's not very well defined. But when we introduced the idea of the reaction coordinate by supposing we took this potential energy surface, right, and we slice right along that steepest descent path and fold it out, and then we have a specific meaning for each point along that line. Okay? A specific geometry, because in that two-dimensional plot, everything had an AB distance and a BC distance, and everything was a specific geometry. Right? But what we saw when balls actually rolled on the surface was they didn't follow that specific trajectory. They could go lots of different ways. So then we generalized it and said that we're not going to have such a specific meaning for the points along this x-axis. We're going to call it the reaction coordinate, but geometrically it's much fuzzier than that. And all we really care about is the valley that's the starting material, the pass that's the transition state, and the valley that's the product, and we'll average over these things, right? So the deeper a valley is, the lower its energy is of the species we're talking about, and the broader the valley is, what does a broad valley mean in terms of the thermodynamics we've talked about? Broad versus narrow. Right. There are many more geometries that are included, that you're including in the name of the valley, for a broad valley than for a narrow valley. So that's entropy, right? The more things you're including, the bigger the entropy is. So there, the altitude of the valley is its enthalpy or heat, and the width is its entropy, and we put them together to get just a single number, which is the free energy. So we have the free energy of the starting material, the free energy of the transition state, the free energy of the product. Okay? And that's all we really care about along the x-axis here, is the starting material, the transition state, and the product. So there's not a specific meaning for the x-axis, a specific geometry. There, we use these collective terms. They're just these three species. Right? Now, but still you can talk about things like the Hammond postulate.